Hey, Judiciary, House Judiciary, come together March 11th. We have with us today Representative Foster, Representative Ledoux, Representative Gruenberg, and myself, Representative Keller, and I expect we'll be joined by others here shortly. What we have on the slate today is HB 81, Revisor's Bill. We'll start there. And then you can come on up, and then we'll move into HB 104. HB 104, we got six amendments here within the last 15 minutes. But my, for the committee, desire is to sometime this week get this bill out, or get, at least vote on it. I mean, your wish, but I mean, your will. Sure. But I really want to get through it this week. So thanks for your hard work.
Move it today.
No.
Oh, that's fine. That's absolutely good.
Yeah, we got lots of amendments, six amendments there. And then lastly, we have HB 108, which is a new bill to us to be heard here, Representative Wilson's bill. So with that, we'll go to HB 81, and I haven't had anybody want to testify except the sponsor of the bill. And I did, but public testimony is open if somebody in the room wants to testify. But do you want to bring us up to date, just kind of have, remind us where we're at? And we had questions, as I remember it, on several points. The questions have all been answered from our perspective. We don't, you know, they're fine.
I'm just here to answer questions. So
yeah.
If I can do that, I'm happy to, but I don't have anything else to add to my previous testimony.
Okay, so if you would just stay right there in case there's questions. But what,
Mr. Chair, my question was answered by Annie Carpinetti. You had the only remaining question on the one section
right. You
were going to look into.
And I, like I say, I have, mine was answered also. And
you're okay.
Yeah, I'm okay. And so there's.
Do you want to move the bill?
Yes, if we're ready, I'm ready.
You want a motion?
Go for it.
Mr. Chair, I move and ask unanimous consent that we move House Bill 81, that's the N version, and any attached fiscal notes. With individual recommendations.
No objections. So HB 81 moves. Thanks for coming over. So with that, the paperwork will be coming around. We can do two things at once. So let's move right into HB 104. What we have, just for clarification, we have version O of the CS in front of us. It was adopted. We have, like I say, six amendments to go through, but we've never stopped and given Gail the opportunity to go over it. So what I'm going to ask her to do is come up, if you would, and give us an overview of HB 104, referring to version O. Yeah, and then we'll begin our work. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. I would be very grateful if Ms. Fanumiai would do it section by section and allow questions, because I have a few questions as we go along.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. Gail Fanumiai, Director of the Division of Elections. I prepared a sectional on work draft version O, and I'll go through that section by section, as was requested by Representative Gruenberg. Section 1.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruenberg.
Sorry to bother you. Do you have a written sectional analysis on the O version?
The only copy I have is the one I'm referring to right now.
Maybe at some point we can get that. That would be helpful to me. Thank you.
Section 1 of the bill specifies that the division may conduct elections for advisory school boards in a regional educational attendance area. The division currently conducts regional educational attendance area elections in 19 REAAs throughout the state on the first Tuesday in October. This will allow the division to do an advisory board election if requested by the advisory board. Section 2 of the bill allows a child turning 18 who resides outside of the United States to register and vote absentee if their parent or guardian was domiciled in Alaska immediately.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. On Section 1, if there is going to be an advisory school board, is the only governmental agency set up to do that the Division of Elections, or do they have local entities that can do it?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, currently the local advisory board conducts their own election.
So this would be an alternative method?
Correct. if the advisory board would request the division to do so.
Okay. This may impact an amendment I intend to offer, but just to flag that.
Section 2?
Section 2 of the bill allows a child who's living overseas with their parents who was not previously domiciled in the state or was not able to register to vote in the state of Alaska before leaving to register and vote absentee if their parent or guardian was immediately domiciled in Alaska before leaving the U.S. This section, as I mentioned, is aimed at voters who are turning 18 while living overseas with their parents or guardian.
May I?
Question, Representative Grunberg.
It says, and also meets the requirements of B2 to 5 of this section. What does that provide?
While you're looking there, for the record, we've been joined by Representative Lynn and Representative Pruitt. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that means that they meet the qualifications established in 1505.0101 and 2. They had not established a domicile in another state, territory, or possession of the U.S. since leaving the state. They're not registered to vote and has not voted in another state, territory, or possession of the United States since leaving the state. Has a valid passport, card of identity and registration, or other identification issued under the authority of the United States Secretary of State and identification complying with the requirement of this title. 1505.0101 states that they're a citizen of the United States, and 1505.0102 states that they're age of 18 or older.
May I inquire, Mr.
Representative Grunberg?
This section caught my eye when I looked at it, because it would seem that as a matter of law, the only way such a newly eligible voter who reached the proper age could vote was if his or her parent had been a domiciliary of the United States. It would disallow that person from establishing their own domicile as a minor. And I could see a circumstance where, well, let's say a refugee situation, somebody comes from Sudan or someplace and the parents can't get out, but the child gets out. And this would seem to disallow that person to establish their own domiciliary status and become a registered voter. And I'm wondering if that was the intent of this, and if so, I'd be interested in knowing whether anybody else sees a constitutional problem with that, because I see some due process issues if that is the intent of this section.
Through the chair, Representative Gruber, this section is related to the qualifications of overseas voters, those voters who are living overseas. It would not impact the ability of somebody moving to the United States to register to vote.
I understand that, but I could see somebody having, in a circumstance, having come to the United States, maybe as a refugee or something, parents still in the other country, and then that person might be going out of the country for college or something like that, and wish to vote, and having been in the country for even a number of years, and then just have gone out for college, for education or whatever. And this would not let them establish a residency in Alaska for the purpose of voting because their parents never came to the United States.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I do not believe that is correct because I believe a person in that situation would be registering to vote once they turn 18, leaving for college. They would meet the qualifications of 1505.010 if they're a citizen of the United States, 18 years of age or older, have been a resident of the state or the House district in which the person seeks to vote for at least 30 days before the election.
So you raise the question, if you would, work it out, and you can reflect on what's being said, and then you can come back with an amendment at a later date whenever you resolve that. Section 3?
Thank you.
Section 3 of the bill was an amendment in House State Affairs which requires poll watchers to be registered voters in the state of Alaska. Section 4 of the bill.
What do you have a question here?
Yes.
Representative Lynn, I'm sorry.
I think at the proper time, Mr. Chair, I'll have an amendment to that section.
Okay, we'll discuss all the amendments.
Yes, I do.
little later, unless you have a question for Gail.
No, I don't. I just want to alert Gail. I don't know if you know this or not yet, but I will have an amendment at the, when you say it's proper to give it.
Super.
We'll discuss. We have, I think, 7 amendments now to the bill, and we're going to go through and at least understand each one of them before we proceed. Representative Ledoux.
One of the things that's always concerned me about poll watchers is when it comes to a primary election, and it looks like poll watchers are appointed by the parties, by the political parties. But if you're dealing with a primary election, and let's say you've got one candidate that is an incumbent and is probably supported, most likely supported as an incumbent by the party establishment, and then you have another candidate who is a challenger and most likely is not supported by the party establishment, it seems kind of unfair that both of those candidates aren't allowed to have their own poll watcher at the polls.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is the correct interpretation of the way the statute is currently written, that the party precinct committee, they appoint a poll watcher. Only candidates who aren't represented by a political party may appoint their own observers.
Through the chair, does anybody else here see a problem with that other than me?
I see it.
Okay, make note of that and consider whether you want to bring a amendment or something forward later. Again, my desire is to try to kill these amendments and not kill them, to get rid of them. Knock them dead as far as any questions so we can put this bill forward. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some problems with these two sections along the lines that the ACLU had in their letter. And so I'll be interested in hearing and seeing what Representative Lynn's comments are, and also Ms. Finumiai, but I really don't want to ask her that question until I've had a chance to see these sections in the context of your proposed amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Section 4 would require members of the State Ballot Counting and Review Board to be registered voters in the state. And a note for the record, that we do get names from the political parties of members to be appointed on that committee, In my 15 years with the division, I cannot recall a time when one has not been a registered voter in the state of Alaska. That's one of the requirements.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you had a chance, and your staff had a chance to review the ACLU letter?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I personally have kind of skimmed through it. Not being somebody in the legal field, Department of Law, I believe, has reviewed that letter.
Do you have a legal opinion from them?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I do not believe we have a written legal opinion. I have Libby Backlar from the Department of Law here to answer any legal questions if you have them at this time.
Okay. Are you expecting a written legal opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we have not requested one, so I don't expect one.
Well, the appropriate time, I'll want to ask them.
Ask them, clarify, ask them questions that SCLU asked, or ask them for a formal memo, and you I'm just curious, a legal opinion.
I'm not sure.
Question.
Okay, fair enough.
Representative, are you relating to the subject of my potential amendments?
No. Well, that too. I mean,
okay.
I know.
Because we can discuss that when the time comes for the amendments.
Sure.
Okay.
Section 5 of the bill was an amendment by Representative Lynn in the House State Affairs Committee that would provide that the name of a person requested an advisory opinion from APOC be kept confidential and redacted from both the request and the opinion before the opinion is made public. And I believe Representative Lynn has an amendment, proposed amendment on that section as well.
Okay.
Section 6 of the bill allows the division to designate municipal clerks as absentee voting officials. It does not mandate that they are absentee voting officials. In places where we do not have absentee voting stations, which are locations that have all 40 House District ballots. And just a note for the committee and for the record is currently there are 49 municipal clerks that serve as absentee voting officials in the state for the division. And I believe in about 7 of them, we do hire additional help for them to be able to conduct that purpose for us.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The figure 15 days on line 19, is that going to be enough time for the municipal clerk to distribute the absentee ballots? Or would they be mailing them out at all, or would these only be for use if people were voting at a station within the municipality?
Through the chair, absentee voting officials is absentee in-person voting, so the person comes to the absentee voting official, and it starts 15 days before the election. And ballots are sent to those officials
if I may.
Quite in advance.
Since they'll be starting to vote 15 days before the election, and they don't get these materials until that very day, and knowing Murphy's Law and how alive and well it is throughout the universe, do you think maybe you should have to get them their ballot materials a little bit earlier than 15 days?
Through the chair, Representative Gruberg, the ballots to absentee voting officials are mailed out at least 22 days prior to the election statewide.
I'm talking about you're having to distribute the ballots to them. It might take a little bit longer. They may not quite get there for 15 days.
Through the chair, Representative Gruberg, we do mail those ballots to the absentee voting officials prior to the start of absentee in-person voting.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have a list of those communities where that would be, those 49 that you had mentioned?
For the chair, Representative Foster, I do have that. I did not bring it with me today, but I'd be happy to share it with the committee.
Okay, I think a lot of those might be in my district, so I'm curious. Thank you.
Section 7.
Section 7 clarifies that voters, other than uniformed service voters or overseas voters, who wish to receive their ballot by electronic transmission, must comply with the same ballot application deadlines applicable to absentee voting in person. And this is due to the fact that federal law allows for uniformed overseas citizens to apply for their ballot electronically at any time during the calendar year. It doesn't mean they get it at any time. Obviously, we don't have ballots available for those voters until 45 days before the election. Section 8 of the bill clarifies that ballots are sent to voters as soon as they are available for distribution, again with the exception of the uniformed service and overseas voters whose ballots, according to federal law, must be mailed 45 days prior to the election. Section 9 of the bill removes the reference to receipt of by-mail ballots postmarked from overseas, which currently is at 15 days, and the proposal is to remove that and have all absentee by-mail ballots be received 10 days following the election. Due to the fact that uniformed and overseas citizens are now getting their ballots about 3 weeks earlier than they used to. Section 10 of the bill adds harmonizing language from federal law that ballots for uniformed service and overseas voters will be mailed 45 days prior to an election. It also adds that voters living, working, traveling outside the U.S. at election time, or those living in remote areas of the state, will have a ballot mailed 45 days prior to an election. Section 11 amends current law related to the mailing of partial count and reject letters to include absentee ballots from a special election under AS 1540-140 or a special runoff election. Section 12 amends current law related to free access for absentee voters to check the status of their ballot to include ballots from a special election under 1540-140 or a special runoff election.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Can we go back to Section 9 for a second? Has the Division of Elections had a problem with ballots coming in after the 10 days? I mean, what is the problem that the Division of Elections is having that it would want to cut off basically disenfranchise servicemen and other people who are overseas, maybe not a great many of them, but certainly a certain number of them, whose ballots wouldn't come in within 10 days?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the division's not trying to disenfranchise or disallow anybody from the ability to return a ballot timely. The military and overseas voters now get their ballots about 3 weeks earlier than a voter who would vote absentee like you and myself. We also have more modern ways for them to get their ballots electronically through online ballot delivery or still by fax. The reason to cut off the 5 days was to assist in preparation to certify the primary election, allow for any court challenges. Those extra 5 days really will butt up to the time when the division can certify the primary and have ballots available for the voters.
Representative LeDuc?
Well, has this been a big problem? Because it's always been my philosophy, if it ain't broken, let's not fix it. So how many ballots are we talking about that have come in and have been timely, came in timely because they were postmarked, but they arrived the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, or 15th day? How many people are we talking about there whose vote wouldn't have counted?
Through the chair, Representative LeDoux, I have somewhere in here, I believe it was 18 ballots that were received by the division. 11 were only deemed to be countable because there were a number of them that were postmarked too late, didn't have a voter signature, or weren't witnessed properly. So there were 11 ballots, I believe, that were counted by the division in that five-day window. That was just for the general election. I don't have any statistics for any other elections. I just got statistics from the most recent election.
I guess I can kind of understand where you may be coming from in the primary, but what would be the rationale at all for the general election?
Through the chair, Representative LeDoux, following the general election, there are no deadlines for the division to follow as far as having to get ballots ready and prepared and mailed.
Thank you. Just for the record, I really don't like the idea of cutting that.
Right, and again, you know, you can contemplate that when we get in the amendments.
Mr. Chairman, I think we were on Section 13, which amends current law related to the mailing of partial count and reject letters to include question ballots from a special election under 1540-140 or a special runoff election. Section 14 amends current law related to free access for voters to check the status of their ballot to include question ballots from, again, a special election under 1540-140 or a special runoff election. Section 15 relates to the mailing of partial count and reject letters to include question ballots from a special election under 1540-140 or a special runoff election. And 16 amends the law related to free access of voters to check the status of their question ballots that would come from a special election or special runoff election. Section 17, again, removes the reference to the 15-day ballot receipt. Section 18 changes the date of the primary election to the second Tuesday in August. Section 19 changes the withdrawal date for the primary election candidates to 52 days prior to the election. It's 4 days earlier than it currently is. Sections 20 and 21 change the dates to replace unopposed incumbent candidates to 54 days prior to the election, and the filling of a vacancy by party petition to 52 days prior to the primary. Sections 22 and 23 change the date to replace a candidate nominated at a primary election to 64 days before the general. Section 24 changes, this was an amendment that was brought up at the last hearing, changes the filing deadline for no party candidates to June 1st. Currently, the no party candidates must file their nominating petition notification by June 1 and their petition signatures no later than 5 p.m. on primary election day. Section 25 changes the withdrawal date for a candidate appearing on the general election ballot to 64 days prior to the election. Section 26 changes the withdrawal date for judicial candidates to 64 days. Section 27 amends 15.
Representative Grunberg.
I'd like to look at Section 25. This would require that a person withdraw 4 days earlier than previously. And the reason for that?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, actually Section 25 deals with the general election. It would have their withdrawal deadline be 16 days earlier than it currently is. 64 days.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes. Why?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that is to give the division adequate time to prepare the ballots to be mailed out to our uniformed overseas citizens. Because currently the withdrawal deadline is at day 48 before the election, and those ballots have to be mailed out 45 days before the election.
And this is because of the new federal law that we really have to move this up, is that right?
Through the chair, that's correct.
I see. Okay.
Section 27 amends AS 1541-40 to require a special election under a new statute for a vacancy in the office of U.S. Senator or U.S. Representative. Section 28.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunberg.
Does Section 27 and maybe something else change the result of an initiative we passed several years ago? Is this affecting the initiative that was passed?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't have the answer to that question.
Because there was an initiative on this by Crawford and those guys, wasn't there?
I believe my understanding, Mr.
Chair,
is that they started an initiative, but the legislature actually passed, you know, similar whatever the qualifications were. So the legislature actually passed the bill.
Representative Grunberg, did you have a follow-up question?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm a little slow on the uptake today. This is pretty complicated.
Yes.
And I'm focusing on Section 27. The reason for that, what was it? It's now going to be under Section 142A, which is set out at the bottom of page 10. What is the change between that and the current law?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, currently there is a special election for the vacancy of United States Senator or U.S. Representative. There is no provision. The changes to these statutes would allow for a special runoff election. So basically, the special election is kind of seen as the primary election. The special runoff is deemed the general election to fill a vacancy. And the special runoff election would have the top two candidates, top two vote getters, advance to the special runoff ballot.
So then they could be the same party.
Through the chair, that Mr. Representative Grunberg, that is my understanding, yes.
Thank you.
Section 28 enacts two provisions regarding special elections and runoff elections. The first provision provides for a special runoff election if no candidate in a special election receives over 50% of the votes cast. The two candidates receiving the most votes would appear on a special runoff election ballot. The second provision establishes the timing of special elections and special runoff elections. The special election for a vacancy in the office of U.S. Senator or U.S. Representative would not be held less than 60 days, no more than 90 days after the vacancy occurs. A special runoff election shall be held on the first Tuesday that is not a state holiday, occurring not less than 60 days after the special election. If a vacancy in an election year in which the candidate for the vacant office is not regularly elected, and the vacancy occurs on a date not less than 60 days, no more than 90 days before the date of the primary, the special election would be held on the primary, and any subsequent special runoff would be held on the date of the general. If the vacancy occurs in an election year in which the candidate for the vacant office is not regularly elected, I think that's a duplicate, so excuse me on that one. Section 29 amends AS 1541-60 to provide for the governor's proclamation of a special election and special runoff. Section 30 amends 1541-65 to add a special runoff election as an election in which a U.S. senator may be elected to fill an unexpired term. Section 31 amends AS 1541-70 to add a special runoff election as an election in which a U.S. representative may be elected to fill an expired term. Section 32 amends 1542-20 to add a special runoff election under the general provisions governing the conduct of a special election and appears to allow for write-in candidates in a special runoff election for U.S. senator or U.S. representative. Section 33 amends current law to include special runoff elections as an election type in which ballot measures could appear. Section 34 includes special runoff elections as an election type in which ballot measures could appear. Sections 35 and 36 amend current law to include special runoff elections as a type of election for which a primary voter pamphlet would be produced if there was a ballot measure on the special runoff election. Section 37 adds a new subsection amending 1558.030 to require the Lieutenant Governor to publish an electronic election pamphlet on the Division's internet website before each state election. Photograph and statement are provided and paid for by candidate, and that the information must be published within 15 days, at least 15 days before the election. Section 38 amends the definition of federal election to include a special runoff election. Section 39 adds federal definitions of absentee uniformed service voters and overseas voters. Section 40 is an amendment to Title 29, which would allow the division to designate municipal clerks as absentee voting officials. Section 41 is the repealer section, which repeals the provision for overseas postmarked ballots to be received 15 days following the election. Repeals the allowance of an absentee application from a uniformed services or overseas voter to be extended for two general elections to harmonize with federal law. Federal law repealed that provision. And repeals a requirement to send special absentee ballots, as those people who qualify for special absentee ballots would now be sent an official ballot 45 days before the election. And Section 42 is the effective date clause.
Representative Pruitt?
Go back. I think it was the repealer on the second one. You mentioned the I didn't understand it. It's absentees for two general elections. What was that again?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. Federal law allowed a uniformed overseas citizen, an absentee voter, to apply for an absentee ballot and have that application be good for the next for two general elections. And that provision of the federal UACAVA Act was repealed by the feds. And it's still in our state law, and we would like to see that repealed as well.
Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
Ms. Fanumiai, through the chair, why did the feds repeal the provision upon which AS 1520081I is based?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the information I received from the Federal Voting Assistance Program, and I believe Patty McGuire is online and could correct me if I'm wrong, is that the military is a highly transient population, and an address they provide in 2012 is not necessarily going to be a valid address for them in 2014. And the division spent a lot of time mailing notices to them asking if we wanted to have, if they wanted to provide an updated ballot mailing address. The address to which we would send the notice to would come back undeliverable with no updated address. And it's best if they just apply every year like everybody else has to get the most current, accurate information.
As to your experience here in Alaska, how many or what percentage of addresses are no good within that period of time?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't have that information or even a guesstimate. I'd have to ask my absentee staff to give me some statistics on that.
And maybe while you're doing that, since we're going to visit this bill again, I'd like that. And I'd also like some more information on what percentage of people you are then not able to reach. These are people who at least presumably, if you could reach them, would at least have a chance at voting in our state elections. And if we just drop them from our rolls, then they may not vote at all or will vote somewhere else if they can, maybe for not all offices. Do you know what percentage then you can't reach or what efforts you're trying? I'm going to need some more information on this.
Through the chair, Representative Gruber, I'll get some statistics on the extended ballot application. Yes.
And again, if I could, for the committee, you know, as these questions come up after the we have the hearing today, please don't wait till the last minute to get the amendments circulated to me so we can circulate them to the committee, because my desire is to give the committee opportunity to act on the bill this week. So,
thanks. I'm working through. I've already submitted some, but I think we're probably going to have some more, and I'm looking at some of these too. This is a complicated bill.
Libby, are you here? Did you want to testify too? And Gail, if you want, you could just bring her up too and stay there, because my guess is that there may be questions. I have Y marked here, Libby, that you want to testify, so if you would identify for yourself for the record.
Sure.
Tell us.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Libby Bacalar. I represent the Department of Law. I was asked to put on record for the governor's office on behalf of the Department of Law a couple of concerns about this bill, specifically Section 24 of the bill, which repeals and reenacts AS 1525-150, changing the petition filing deadline for no-party candidates from the date of the primary election to June 1. No-party candidates appear only on the general election ballot and don't participate in the primary. A review of prior AG opinions and the case law implies that that requirement is likely unconstitutional under the First Amendment and the Voting Rights Clauses of the Alaska Constitution, because it limits the ability of those candidates to access the ballot without sufficient state interest to justify the infringement on those rights. Those rights are interpreted in Alaska at least as broadly and often more broadly than their federal counterparts, and receive strict scrutiny under which the state has to show a compelling reason for the enactment. A system such as the one proposed by Section 24, in which no party candidates have to submit their petition and signatures before the date of the primary, either August 1 or June 1, have been found or implied unconstitutional in two Superior Court decisions from 1988 and 1990, respectively, most notably the latter of those two in an injunction issued by Dana Fabe, who's now on the Supreme Court. The rationale of the courts is that because no party candidates are not required or cannot run in the primary election, there's no justification for imposing the June 1 filing deadline sufficient to outweigh those candidates' right to speak and associate in the intervening period between the primary and the general in order to gather support for the general. Current law creates a bifurcated system in which nominating petition candidates, or these no party candidates, have to declare and submit most candidacy information by June 1, but don't have to file their full petition with voter signatures until the primary date. That system, as we've opined previously, is likely constitutional. The new proposed system may not be. So that was the primary concern that I was asked to make part of the record today.
And for the record, Libby, we have an amendment that I believe is going to address that, and we'll try to get to it as a First Amendment, because that way, if you're still here, you know, you can answer any questions related to those changes. But rather than respond, Representative Gruenberg, to this, I would prefer to hear the amendment and then in that context discuss.
You've got one brief question. Okay. This only relates to Section 24, right?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, that's correct, to Section 24 moving. And this provision has moved back and forth over the years, from August 1 at one point, I think, to the primary, to June 1 back and forth. The system we have now, it's our opinion, is probably fine from a constitutional standpoint.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any further questions for either Libby or Gail? Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you. I thought you were going to talk about two different things, but you only came up to talk about the one?
I did come up to talk about the one. I had originally also was prepared to talk about Section 3 of the bill, which I understand you had a question about.
Three and four. Have you had a chance to review the ACLU's memo?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I have reviewed the letter, yes.
Do you agree with them?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I don't know that I have had time to fully agree with them or not. What I would say is that the letter does raise some concerns for me, simply because the Equal Protection Clause starts from a premise of the state needs a legitimate, it's a sliding scale analysis, but essentially we need a legitimate interest connected in a fair and substantial way to the classification that's being made in order for that to be valid. Because the Equal Protection Clause is a fundamental right, and the requirement to make poll watchers registered voters doesn't bring to mind an immediate administrative priority necessarily, I would just say that the ACLU's letter, resonates some valid concerns, I think it's fair to say.
Well, I won't ask further because we're going to have an amendment
on that,
too.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll wait on that. Thank you. And while you're there, Patty McGuire, did you have something you wanted to add to our discussion in lightness?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. My name is Patty McGuire. I'm Deputy Director of the Federal Voting Assistance Program in Washington, D.C., also an ex-Alaskan and former Alaska House Page many, many years ago. We just wanted to mention very briefly, applaud the division and the Lieutenant Governor's leadership on moving the primary election in Section 18. We think that's critical to Alaska being able to comply with the 45-day requirement of the Help America Vote Act. And while Alaska was able to comply in 2012, had there been a recount or any issue arose after the election, compliance would have been problematic. And so we believe that moving the primary is an important step. On the Section 2 on enfranchising children of U.S. citizens who are children of ex-Alaskans, Alaska expatriates, that have never resided in the United States. And this is a very narrow point of law and applies to very few people nationally, but we think it's an important step. Alaska would be the 29th state to enfranchise children of former Alaskans, and we think that's an important step. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee has, but that's all I had to say.
I don't see any right now. Representative Grunberg?
Actually, before I ask you that question, I need to ask Ms. Finumiai a question, or somebody. I can't tell if on line 14 of page 1, since there's 1 and 2, if there should be an and at the end or an or at the end. Since you're speaking for the administration, are these combined or alternatives?
Again, what is the page and line reference?
Page 1, line. Last word on page 1. Is it that they may register and vote absentee if they have met the requirements of both paragraph 1 and 2, or is it or 1 or 2?
Through the chair, I believe there's a drafting issue there, and it should say and.
Okay, well, at the appropriate time, we'll deal with that. My question to you, Mr. McGuire, and I don't know if you heard my dialogue with Ms. Finumiai a few minutes ago, but for a person whose parent or legal guardian wasn't ever in the United States, we'll say, this would prohibit such a minor from acquiring a residence in Alaska on their own. Do you have any comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, the number of people who have not resided, the number of U.S. citizens who have never resided in the United States is relatively small. The number of people who have never resided in the United States whose parents have never resided in the United States, I think would be an incredibly small number nationally, let alone for Alaska. This does not require, my understanding is this does not require one's parents to have resided in Alaska to separately establish residency in Alaska, but one would have to be a resident of Alaska for 30 days and then qualify under normal state procedures. Does that answer your question?
I know I have.
Representative Grunberg, did you have a follow-up?
I know that this has happened. And in other countries, a lot of people were affected in World War II. A lot of kids got out of Nazi Germany, and they were sent to Great Britain and the United States, and their parents never left.
And where we left that, you know, I'm glad you asked for Patty's input. Where we left that is you're going to be working on this and documenting maybe, and later on we can address it in the next meeting.
Sure, and maybe at that time Ms. Bacalar could address that too.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to call in. Are you going to stay online for a while as we work through this in case other questions arise?
If you'd like me to, Mr. Chairman, I will.
Well, I don't want to impose on your time, but that would be helpful. Thank you.
I will.
Okay. Any other questions for Gail Fanumiai or Libby? Seeing none, and I see no other. We have, by the way, on the line to answer questions. We have our legislative drafter, Alpheus Bullard, is online, and we'll be looking to him on what I want to do is take the First Amendment that he's been working on, which addresses the questions that Libby brought forward. And then also John Tassin, Attorney General's Office, is online for questions. Paul DeFinius from the APOC is online for questions. And so with that, we're going to close public testimony. Unless somebody in the room jumps up and I missed them, I don't see any. Okay, public testimony is closed. And we're going to go now before the committee, and if you would move amendment number one.
Mr. Chairman, I would respectfully move amendment number one. It's page one, line one, following procedures, and insert relating to reporting of election campaign contributions and expenditures.
And there's more to it, but just give us the number.
Would be, yeah. 28-GH1983/0.10, dated 3/6/13.
Great. And we have Tom Wright with us from the Speaker's office, and he's going to come up. And Alpheus, would you confirm that you're online for questions?
Through the chair, this is Alpheus Bullard of Ledge Legal, and yes, I'm available online.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Mr. Chairman, this amendment addresses what Ms. Bacalar was discussing, and through the help of John Patasson and Ms. Bacalar of the AG's office, I think we have this issue resolved. In fact, I'm probably about 99% sure the issue is resolved with one detail that has to be addressed throughout the bill. And I will ask for Mr. Bullard's help. We discussed this morning, and I'm still a little dense about some of the process here, especially in the Section 5 portion. And Mr. Bullard can explain that better. But in Section 6, what this requires is a candidate who is running as a nominated candidate, or a candidate seeking nomination by petition is the proper terminology, requires them to have, they're considered a candidate, so it requires them, even though they're not appearing on the primary ballot, to file a report 30 days before the primary and also 7 days before the primary. So at least there's some transparency within those campaigns that other candidates are subjected to.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you receive any, through the chair, Mr. Wright, did you receive any a legal opinion or oral legal opinion from Mr. Bullard?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, we did receive a legal opinion, and that's what brought forth our attempt to cover this amendment. The other change that needs to be made, Mr. Chairman.
Well, for the record, Representative Grunberg, that memo should be in front of you. We distributed it. Go ahead.
I don't think I said my name for the record. I'm sorry about that, Mr. Chairman. Tom Wright, staff to Speaker Chenault. The other change I would recommend after discussing with Mr. Bullard is the deletion of Section 24 in the O version of the bill, and then ask Mr. Bullard to make any conforming changes. That would be a conceptual amendment, Mr. Chairman, that someone on your committee obviously would have to move.
Right.
But I would recommend that we delete Section 24 and then allow Mr. Bullard to make any conforming amendments that might change because of this deletion.
Before we get to Section 24, since this amendment only deals with what will be a new Section 5 and a new Section 6, if I could ask Mr. Bullard a question. I was going to go down a different path.
Yeah, please go ahead and ask.
Mr. Bullard, are you on the line?
Yes,
Yes, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I am available online.
Since the bill itself deals with elections and this amendment deals with campaigns, do you see that being a single subject problem?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, the bill relates to various election practices and procedures, and I think that campaign finance in the context of Alaska elections is well within the within that scope.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Tom? You moved Amendment 1, and I forgot if somebody objected, but we proceeded as if somebody objected.
You
object, okay.
I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Is there any other objections for Amendment Number 1? Okay. Amendment Number 1 passes. Thank you. I think we're going to move to Representative Lynn has several.
Mr. Eisenman, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead.
First.
Oh,
one,
I'm sorry. Thank you. I better remember what you want. We need for Amendment Number 2, Conceptual Amendment Number 2. Will somebody move the deletion of Section 24?
Mr. Chair, I would move that.
Seeing no objection, Section 24 is deleted as part of a conceptual amendment to go with Amendment Number 1. Did I say that right?
Mr. Chairman, yes, but I would also ask some latitude in allowing Mr. Bullard to make any conforming changes that might need to be made with the elimination or the deletion of this amendment.
So moved, unless there's an objection. Yeah. So thank you. We're fine with that. Chairman. Thank you. Okay. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move, I guess it would be Amendment 3, would it not?
Right.
Move Amendment Number 3. This is to Line 2, Line 17, delete registered to vote in the state and insert a United States citizen and the same language on Line 3, 2-3.
Okay, that was Page 2, Line 17, and Page 3, Lines
2 and 3.
Mr. Chair, I think this is 0.11.
You want to?
0.11 is the official number. We're calling it number 3. Is there an objection? Seeing no objection?
I'm not objecting to the amendment. I may object further to this section of the bill.
Okay. So, seeing no objection, amendment number 3 passes.
Okay. How about this one?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would move Amendment Number 4 to 28-GA-1983/0.9 to this bill. That'd be on page 3, lines 10 through 13. And a section to delete. It says a person's delete a person. Name a person requesting an advisory opinion to change it to at the request. Unless you want me to read the entire paragraph.
No, I think we can all read it.
And this is Amendment 4.
And this is, just for the record, this is 1983 0.9. I'm sorry if you said that already, but that is from Mr. Bullard.
Okay.
Okay, any objection to this? I'll object. Give us a few minutes here. Just read it over, make sure you understand it, and then I'll remove my objection.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I think this is a really good amendment, and I was planning to.
My amendment.
That's what you meant, right, Representative Grunberg?
Yeah. Yes.
Gotcha.
I had one, just gave it to That's Ernest. I don't need a 9 now. That's good.
Okay, I'll remove my objection. Any further objection on amendment number
4?
4. Seeing none.
Thank you.
It moves. Okay, I think what we're going to do is go to Representative Gruenberg and let you move your amendments, if you would, and tell us which ones you're...
Yeah, I'm still doing some, but I'm going to do first one. It's going to be conceptual, and I don't have it in writing. It's on page 1, line 14, in line with what we asked Ms. Fanumiai and Ms. Bacalar. At the very end of line 14, after the semicolon, insert the word and, so we make sure that 1 and 2 are conjunctive, not disjunctive.
I don't see any objection, so that's amendment number 5.
Five.
The word and. This feels like the budget time for crying out loud. And did you have any further amendments, Representative Grunberg?
Yes. Okay, I'm going to offer at this time amendment number
six.
Number six.
And the version on top is the
O.6.
I'll object, but this is amendment number 6, and it is 1983.0.6.
And I would, I'm not sure that I'm going to want to take a vote on this today for a reason that I wasn't prepared before. Section 1 of the bill deals with REAAs, and I'm not sure how, whether we're going to have to do some kind of a conforming amendment to take in Section 1 into Amendment 6. So I don't want to move the amendment at this point.
Would you remove?
Yeah, I remove my motion.
Okay, so Amendment number 6 is withdrawn, with a hint that we'll be seeing something.
Some version of that.
Yeah. Did you have another one, Representative Gruenberg?
The only other one I was considering today was Amendment 0.5. But I really don't want to offer them yet. Because in light of some of the questions of why they got rid of the federal law, maybe I can ask Mr. McGuire, if you don't mind. Could I ask Patty McGuire a question?
Please.
Mr. McGuire, are you still on the line?
I am, sir.
Okay. Any information, additional information, you can provide on the history of the repeal of the federal law that allowed military and overseas people to get absentee ballots for a 2-election cycle?
I would say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg, that that Ms. Fanumiai summarized the congressional discussion that went on in 2009 pretty well. And the concern was that states and localities were spending a huge amount of money sending ballots to voters in places where they no longer were, and expending a lot of money and a lot of energy. The military population is very mobile. In addition, we at the Department of Defense spend a lot of resources encouraging people to fill out a new federal postcard application every year for precisely this reason. And so we believe a shorter applicability for the federal postcard application makes sense.
Okay. My concern had been the opposite, that there are people here in Alaska, big state, who have trouble getting to the polls, and they customarily vote absentee. Did you have any testimony at the federal level on the advisability of opening that provision up to people maybe who are less mobile, but maybe even more dependent, or at least as dependent, on absentee ballots by mail?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, my understanding is that my review of the testimony was that it was only about military and overseas voters in as part of the discussion of the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act. So I don't believe that there was discussion among the Congress about how non-military or overseas voters absentee ballots should be treated.
Thank you. I don't have any more questions.
Okay. Thank you again, Patty, for answering questions. Any other Representative Ledoux?
So I'd like to make a conceptual amendment, if I could, right now.
Okay.
Section 3. And that conceptual amendment would be to allow in primary elections each candidate to select a poll watcher. Do you want this more formulated into a formal amendment at some point, or?
Yes, I think that would be a smart thing to do. And then you can get Gail Fanumiai's feedback and make sure it's what you want. And then, again, if you would try to get this done tomorrow so that we can, look at this again Wednesday if time allows. But if that is agreeable?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. That's absolutely agreeable.
Great. Okay.
Oh, Mr. Chair,
if
we're about at the end of the road on this bill today, I would request that the chair invite the staff to come up with a new CS incorporating the new amendments that we adopted today.
I think that we can probably manage that. Thank you for the suggestion.
Thank you.
So with that, we'll put HB 104 aside, and we'll look at it again. We'll try to put it in actually first, after we have some confirmations on Wednesday and see where we come out with it. So.
That's good.
Good. Okay, and it wasn't so bad as we thought.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
And, there was actually a lot of food for thought there.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and I'm not sure.
Okay, so now we're going to move into HB 108. This is Representative Wilson is here, if you would. Introduce yourself and your staff and the bill, please.
Thank you. I'm Representative Peggy Wilson from House District 2, and this is my intern, Elijah Verhagen. And he knows this bill better than I do, but I will start out and then I'll let him answer most of the questions because he has really spent a lot of time on this. So. Okay, House Bill 108.
Wait, before you get started,
oh yes,
I think we better make sure we all have the same version in front of us. So I think if somebody wants to move as a working version, I think it's version U, just to make sure that we got the right one.
I have an O version.
O version is what it is? Yeah, you're right. I was on the
O. I just have U here. Anybody have O?
I have O and U.
Oh. Hold on.
I just have you.
Here's the original.
You have you also?
Okay, take a little of ease till we get our paperwork. Record, please proceed talking about HB 108. And we do have version O in front of us now.
I will object for discussion.
Okay, we have an objection. Don't let me forget to ask you to remove your objection when we get to that point. Thanks. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. House Bill 108 will allow the Alaska State Troopers and the Municipal Police Departments to add a $10 surcharge on all minor offense tickets as a means of funding the purchase and maintenance of electronic citation equipment to issue tickets. Now, currently in some areas of the state, it takes an average of 18 minutes to write up a paper ticket. Now, if there are multiple offenses and they have to write three or four tickets, it could take up to 45 minutes of the officer's and the defendant's time. Now, and that is because every time if they stop somebody and they're and it was, they stopped them from, because they didn't signal when they went around the corner, and they also had a taillight out, that would be two different tickets. And so, and they have to write that as two different tickets. And that won't change with this. However, the time it takes to do it will change dramatically. After they issue the ticket, then it takes as long as 12 days while those tickets are turned in, typed into the system, and processed. Many human errors, weather damage, handwriting, and fading writing on the tickets make a large percentage of these collected paper tickets invalid. Because when they're out there, just think of it, especially in Southeast, when they're out there trying to write a ticket to somebody and they're leaning against the car and they're writing and it's raining and the paper's getting wet and whatnot. So a lot of these tickets then are invalidated because they can't read parts of them. Through federal and state grants and city taxes, over 75% of our Alaska's police and state troopers are currently using and familiarizing their officers with e-citation equipment. This increases officer and defendant safety by reducing the time it takes to issue a ticket on the side of the road down to an average of 6 minutes per ticket and about 10 minutes for three tickets. So that's a big difference. The information is then uploaded electronically into the system so that the defendant can go pay for his fine, often in the same day in which it was written. Human errors in handling of the paper tickets is eliminated, saving time and money in the courts and in the city offices. Currently, e-citation equipment establishment costs are being funded by federal grants, and those grants are disappearing. The Alaska State Troopers and the majority of the municipal police in the state are now using this equipment to issue tickets. Without this legislation, however, the Department of Public Safety will have to request the state to fund to pay the continuing costs of this e-citation equipment. This bill assists the Department of Public Safety and the participating municipalities in paying the annual fees and maintenance costs of e-citation equipment by passing that cost on to the offenders so they won't have to come to the legislature for funding. This will have a zero fiscal impact on the state's budget. By amending the existing statute that places a $10 surcharge on minor offenses for police training, the court system has stated that they can make the operational changes in their fiscal department and implement this legislation with existing staff and technical support and without incurring costs to the state. The courts are also able to revise the statewide citation forms that DPS and most city police departments use to make the surcharge $20 instead of $10 without needing extra funding to do so. Certain city police departments throughout the states collect and send this $10 surcharge currently, and collecting and distributing the increased amount will not fiscally impact them. Similar e-citation surcharge legislation has passed in the state of Illinois and has been very successful in the past 6 years. My office has been in close contact with the counties that are doing this, and they are eager to help us and share their success stories, and we have them online. We have letters of support also from two of their counties, DuPage and Lake County. We also have support from the Department of Public Safety, Alaska State Troopers, the Association of Police Chiefs, the City of Anchorage and Fairbanks, Juneau, and Ketchikan, and many more. All are excited about this legislation and believe it will greatly help our state. I urge you to pass this bill it will improve our safety and the officers' safety while on the side of the road, and it will eliminate the ticket data entry for the courts and will not raise taxes on the public, nor will it take money from our general fund. And Elijah will... He can answer the questions better than I can, so I'm in the middle of another committee, but I will stay for a while and see how things go.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. I haven't received any confirmation yet of who's online, but I was told that Judge Brin from Illinois is going to be available. We also have Lieutenant Rodney Dial from Alaska State Troopers, Kelly Howell, Kelly was in the room, but anyway, Public Safety, Jeff Hoover, Public Safety, and Nancy Mead from the court system are all going to be online to, for questions. And before we turn it over to Elijah, we also have Elijah's dad in the office. So if you're going to be mean to the representative, not Elijah. Any questions for Representative Wilson, Representative Foster?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will the rural hub communities such as Nome, Bethel, Kotzebue, Barrow be participating in this and have access to those funds? You had mentioned a number of communities. I just want to make sure rural communities were also going to be a part of this, or at least have the opportunity to have access to it.
For the record, my name is Elijah Verhagen. I'm intern for Representative Peggy Wilson. And to answer your question, Representative, through the chair, Representative Foster, to answer your question, yes, Nome actually is currently using form of e-citation. Many of the rural police departments are being set up with e-citation through the track steering committee out of Anchorage. And I have a list I can give the committee of the cities and the police departments that are currently using e-citation equipment. I can give to you guys if you want.
Thank you.
Representative Pruitt.
So who determines how the money is going to be spent that's collected in this fund?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. For my in the bill, if you go to second page, on line 20, starting in line 28, it says the legislature may make appropriations from the fund to the Department of Public Safety for the purchase and maintenance of equipment and supplies that are used by the state or by municipalities to issue electronic citations. So within the Department of Public Safety, they will establish the regulations if this bill is passed, and someone from within that department will be in charge of distributing those funds. Also in on page 2, starting on line 18, we have language that is amended in there that says the department and the administrative director of the Alaska court system may enter into agreements with each other and with other state agencies and municipalities to provide a statewide system to administer electronic citations. And so the cities that want to participate in this e-citation program can work out an agreement with the Department of Public Safety, and they will receive funding to pay for their equipment, because most of these rural cities themselves would never be able to afford the e-citation equipment.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. So I just want to make clear, is it the department that's going to be determining where the funds are being spent, or does it still have to be appropriated in the end by the legislature?
It is, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it is the someone within the Department of Public Safety. From my understanding, it is the track steering committee. However, Kelly Howell, the legislative liaison, is here, and she probably can answer your question better than that if you want to bring her up.
Okay. When Kelly comes forward, we'll do that. Any other questions for the sponsor? Before you got a few more minutes? I have a question. This isn't a mean question, but it's going to sound like it. I want to know, if it's so efficient, why is there extra cost? I don't get it. In other words, if we save time with the both the policeman and the court system in the typing and transcribing and all this, why is it that just exactly what is in the equipment that we don't now have and the maintenance that is so expensive?
Well, if I understand it, it's the right now the federal government has funded what we have out there now, but there is a cost to maintain these, and in order to cover the cost to maintain it, that's going to be what we collect with the $10, so that that will be cost, so that no one will be coming to the state and say, gee, we can't maintain these now, and we can't keep up the fees, because there's a fee every year for being able to use this citation equipment, or I'm not sure how that fee works. Someone else can probably explain that, but That's every year. And you're if I understand what you're asking, well, we're going to be collecting this money now, so we should be paying, the cost should be less somewhere else. And what we're doing is we're not adding to the cost because we're going to use the cost of something that's already in place. So we're not going to be saving money, or we won't be able to say, okay, you're not spending this money, so we're going to take it back. We aren't going to be able to do that because we're spending the money on something else right now. And so this is they're going to be, by just a switch of a switch or however that works, be able to include this in what they're doing now at little cost.
Okay, thank you. Did you have something on that point? Because I have okay, go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
Has any state or have you considered, along with this, allowing the fine to be paid by credit card right there so that the person would have their little machine, issue the citation, could run the credit card through, immediate repercussion? It's like when you discipline a child, you do it immediately.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we haven't thought of that yet, of paying with a credit card. However, one of the officers from Juneau, the Juneau Police Department is currently using e-citation equipment. They came and did a demonstration for me and Representative Wilson, and they showed us how it works. And before the person can pay the fine, it is done electronically on a laptop in their car, but then the police officer has to go back to the station and update, transmit what he has on his laptop in his car, and they unhook it and they'll bring it inside, and then they'll send, from what I understood from them, they have to go back to the station, transmit the tickets that they did that day, and then those people could come in and pay, you know, basically right after. And so sometimes they'll come in, they said, they'll come into their station and they've done, say, four or so tickets in the morning on their lunch break or after, before they go back out. They can transmit those into their system, and then the person could go pay in the afternoon. But it is not to the point yet, from our understanding, that where they can just pay right there with a credit card.
Mr. Chair, since we seem to have everybody in the world on the line, maybe somebody could pick up on that question, because, you know, everybody now, whether you're buying a meal on the plane or anything, they all have their little credit card things, and they could just do it and immediately, and they could go back and do their paperwork afterward, but they'd get the money. People would be on their way.
Representative Lynn and Representative Ledoux.
Of course, to use a credit card, there's a fee that the merchant pays. In this case, the police department would pay, and that had to be added to the cost or something done, because it would be an added cost for whatever the percentage is. That's why a lot of merchants don't take a credit card, or they don't want to take a credit card, or they charge a little extra.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you mentioned that they would come down to the station to pay. What about paying online? I know when you have a parking violation, and it's in the municipality of Anchorage, and I don't know whether other municipalities do it the same way, but you can pay your parking violation. You can pay that online. Can you pay your moving violation online too?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you may be able to. And that's up to certain municipalities. Currently, I don't know if people are doing that right now, but I could find that out for you. And Kelly Howell might also be able to answer that for you.
Yeah. Well, we have several, that will probably be able to respond to. Nancy's back there. She can probably give us insight. Rodney Dial. So that's a great question. Representative Lynn?
No, I'm just scratching my beard.
Oh, I thought you had one. Okay. You were signaling me. Okay. Another question I have for you before you get away. in the world of electronics, things change very quickly. I was reading in Popular Mechanic last night on the way down where a guy just had an infected gallbladder out with his robot. It was a horrible-looking thing. You know? And, of course, it was being operated by a surgeon, a skilled surgeon. It was more an extension of his hands. My point is that things change quickly. And there's and I have a concern when I read this bill when it talks about being able to electronically create a citation and electronically issue. And both terminologies are used. So it isn't something you have to answer right now. I don't believe that it was the sponsor's intent in any way to authorize, for example, a radar camera that can send tickets in the mail. But I would like some confirmation that as we go along that is not possibly made possible with this bill, because things change. So in 10 years from now, when you look back at this terminology in this bill, it could look like it was written to enable that kind of thing, so I want to put something in their letter of intent or whatever. But I'm working on that in my head, and I want to give you a chance to respond to that before you go.
I believe Peggy Wilson, Mr. Chairman, I believe Section 4 of the bill, that's a new section that we added, and starting kind of like on line 28, the legislature may make appropriations from the fund to the Department of Public Safety for the purchase and maintenance of equipment and supplies that are used by the state or the municipalities to issue electronic citations. So nothing in this section creates a dedicated fund. If that doesn't take care of it, and we can ask about that, if that doesn't take care of it, I that would be fine with me to make sure that we put something in there that prohibits that, if you want. I mean, however you want, that would be fine with me.
Thank you. I'll follow up on that. And this kind of, I think, carries on from Representative Pruitt's question. I'm not sure. But maybe we need to be more specific in the bill on what this fund will be used for. To me, it doesn't really explain it. Maintenance, what is it? Buying equipment and maintenance, you know. And maybe just some tighter parameters on that, because if I understood the implications from your question, the way I was seeing it anyway, we're creating a pocket of money that can be accessed, you know, for electronic citations. So let's, I just want to give it some thought, or if the committee would help me give it some thought on what an electronic citation is, and maybe put that in the bill too, if you're open to that.
Yeah,
I am. Sign
me. Representative Lynn?
Do you sign the citation? Did somebody sign it?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, yes, you do. You can sign it electronically.
Okay, great. Any other questions for the sponsor or Elijah? Representative Grunberg.
This is kind of the same kind of question I asked with the and amendment on the last one. If you folks look at the sentence beginning on page 2, line 28, there are two ways of interpreting that sentence. One way, as a statement of limitation, the legislature may only make appropriations for the purchase and maintenance of equipment, or that instead of being limitation, it could be read as a statement of authorization, and it could be read, the legislature in its discretion may make appropriations. And which way did you folks mean that sentence?
I just want this to be able to the departments, the police departments, and the troopers across the state would be able to maintain, to the ones that don't have them now, to purchase and maintain. You know, if one gets damaged or something, then they would have to maintain it. Or maybe replace it or whatever. I just want them to be able to do it without coming to the legislature and say, we need more money.
Then I think we're going to have to look at the way that sentence is drafted.
Okay.
we can talk about.
Do you have a further question?
Yeah, no, I want to make a comment. I think it's very possible that if we're not careful with the wording here, that we could allow through funding policy decisions to be made outside of the legislature. And I think that's where we have to be, control our limitations here. So I think you got that. Thank you.
Any other questions? We got several online, and maybe somebody in the room, I don't know, to testify on this, but we'll. I don't plan to move the bill today. We don't really want to get a few things answered. And so.
Maybe there's a gentleman in the second row from the back who wants to critique your performance.
Representative Grunberg is making reference to Elijah's dad, and I've seen him smiling back there, and so I think we're okay.
Yeah, did a good job.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so let's go. I have Lieutenant Dial, Alaska State Troopers, on from Ketchikan. I want to go to you first, if I could, Lieutenant Dial, and you're on a note to answer questions, but I was wondering if you had anything you wanted to add. And Representative Grunberg, did you have something?
Before we do this, I should remove my objection so we have this.
Thank you.
It looks to me like there are so many changes with the original, it's not going to be fruitful to go through the changes. So I remove my objection to the O version.
Okay. And then the working version we have in front of us is version O, and thank you for reminding me. I wouldn't want to have forgotten that. Lieutenant Dial, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Mr. Chairman, I am online for the record. My name is Rodney Dial, Lieutenant with the State Troopers out of Ketchikan. I would just like to say that, regarding accepting funds on the roadside, we've not considered that. However, we would be a little concerned of the appearance of soliciting funds immediately, in that it could discourage those who wish to contest the citation in court as allowed by law. As you've already heard, the department currently operates an electronic citation program. We call that TRACS. It basically stands for Traffic and Criminal Software. It's an application that combines a laptop computer and our patrol vehicles, computers in a central office, and data communications that allow us to prepare and issue electronic citations. The ability for us to do that, as opposed to the old handwritten multiple copy forms, does increase our productivity and does increase officer safety for the offender and the officer by decreasing the amount of time we spend on the side of the roads. Currently, we're spending about $62,000 per year to license the software elements and to provide maintenance. The hardware cost is about $7,500 per vehicle, which includes computer terminal, mount, scanner, and printer. We are utilizing federal funds paid through the Alaska Highway Safety Office to fund this program. And currently, the majority of our troopers in posts connected to the road system are using this system. We're expanding this as we're able to. We recently brought the Klawak area in southeast Alaska and are working with other police agencies in Alaska to help them implement electronic citations as well. And just to close, we do support House Bill 108 as a means to maintain our electronic citation program and expand it to the municipal police departments across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Dial. I don't see any questions for you at this time. I guess I have one. It was implied that state troopers give less tickets on a rainy day. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, no comment on that.
Okay. Thank you. No comment. thanks for calling in, and if you'll stand by, there may be other questions. Keith Brin, is it Judge Brin from Circuit Court, Illinois?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, everyone, for having me here.
If you would, identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Keith Brin, and I'm the Circuit Court Clerk in Lake County, Illinois. And the bill that you are discussing here today, this House Bill 108, is very, very similar to the law in Illinois that we adopted years ago relating to electronic citations. So I thought I'd be able to provide you some insights about the legislation and our experience in Illinois. For many of the reasons that you've already touched on, e-citations are very, very popular with law enforcement and the courts. Electronic citations are printed rather than handwritten. They can be sent electronically by the issuing officer to the court, and they can be automatically incorporated into our court record management system. In addition to something that I believe Representative Wilson already touched on in regarding the efficiencies to law enforcement in making the ticketing process much quicker. There's also an efficiency that we see on the back end in courts regarding handling tickets. Basically, data entry and processing costs for us are becoming much, much more efficient with electronic citations. Our budgets, as you undoubtedly are already going through, are very stretched. But we have to fund the courts. We have to make sure that we're doing the best we can for the public. And as in my particular instance, as the Circuit Court Clerk of Lake County, with the third biggest county in Illinois, we're basically the hub of the court system. So if something isn't working right with us, it's got repercussions throughout the entire court system and inevitably throughout the entire state and beyond. Just to start with, electronic citations assure that the citations that are issued are legible, there are no handwriting errors, and can be reproduced just as the day they were issued, if required, wherever it's required to be reproduced. We still have a paper-based system, thanks to our Supreme Court, which dictates the rules by which we operate in our courts. But that doesn't mean we have to be plagued by issues of data entry. For example, even if we had a perfectly legible ticket, one of my clerks would get a ticket across the counter from a police officer, and it could take them 10 to 15 minutes to not only interpret that ticket, but data entry every single point that is required in our courts to create a court case. That's a lot of wasted time. Never mind, even as the best clerk will go, we're dealing with human beings, so there will be errors in entry that have to then be solved and resolved later in court, which again, doesn't get to the merits of anything. They're just problems and errors with the system. Electronic citations allow us to get through all of those and deal with them very efficiently. And so my clerks can look more at quality control and really working to help the court system adjudicate matters. In addition, there's also timing issues that we deal with. For example, in Illinois, a DUI ticket written may result in a summary suspension if the defendant doesn't want to submit to a breathalyzer. This can also be contested in a later hearing, but there's a time limit. The clock starts ticking on defendants to contest these matters, and it doesn't start ticking from the time the ticket is entered as a court case. The clock in Illinois starts ticking from the time the ticket is written. So as you can imagine, if there's any delays from when the ticket is written to when it is brought in, turned in, which could be days later, and entered as a court case, a very ambitious defense attorney could come in the next day, because obviously his client is well aware that there was a DUI, and want to contest something on a court case that doesn't yet exist. So there's a timing problem. Now, this doesn't completely resolve it, but in general, with the speed, I believe the testimony was already presented, it's similar in Illinois. Once the ticket is written, the officer then would eventually turn in the laptop or the data to their control system, which would then automatically upload once the edits have been confirmed into our system. That's much, much faster than doing it by hand. So in Illinois, ultimately, the legislature adopted a $5 fee to citations and misdemeanors to help essentially finance these projects in different circuits. Now, our particular fund is a segregated fund. It is not part of the general revenue fund. It's specifically for electronic citation creation, maintenance, and support. But in either case, and with your bill and with ours, one of the most wonderful things from my perspective as an elected official is that this doesn't have an impact on the state budget. We don't ask for tax dollars. We're doing something as a result of people who are part of the system, who have had matters of DUIs, traffic tickets, other misdemeanors into our system, and we're improving the system. That's a win-win, and that's why there's been tremendous amount of support from local governments, police, sheriff's department, from judges and other administrators. And I understand, actually, our bill has been so successful in other states that actually it's been introduced roughly in 17 or so other states using Illinois as model legislation, so it really has been one of the more successful bills across the country. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for calling in. I see no questions for you at this time. So is there anybody in the room that wants to testify on HB 108? I don't think we've missed anybody. I see we could call on, if you have questions, Representative Grunberg?
For Ms. Mead.
I see Nancy Mead is here from the courts, and we have a question for you.
Hello, for the record, this is Nancy Mead from the Alaska Court System, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. The changes from the original U version to the O version, it looks to me like the court system and the Department of Public Safety and the sponsors worked together to come up with a better protocol on this. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, we did work with the staff of Representative Wilson's office and have spoken with the Department of Public Safety so that we could create a system that didn't cause any problems for the court system that the court could implement, because we do collect surcharges on some of the tickets that are filed electronically.
And as far as both of you, and I'm looking at Elijah too, everybody has signed off on this and it's okay?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the court can do this, yes. We're neutral as to the policy in the bill, whether to create the fund, but we can implement it.
That was my question.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Representative Grunberg, do you have another question?
No, and the Supreme Court then will promulgate some kind of an administrative rule implementing this after the bill passes, I think.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't know that that's necessary. E-citations are already in place for certain cities and for the state troopers, as you know and have heard. That is authorized by Supreme Court rule already, and it's ongoing. It's happening in many communities, not all, and not all file their tickets immediately with the court. If you get a ticket from the state troopers, that their handheld ticket writers populate the court system's database of cases immediately. If you get them from certain municipalities, such as Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, big ones, they don't. We collect on some cities' tickets, but not on others. So the surcharges that we collect, we already transfer to other. We already collect a surcharge, for example, for police training, and transfer those to the Police Standards Council. This would be an additional surcharge. Our fiscal operations department can implement it without a Supreme Court order.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I add one thing, Mr. Chairman? People can pay their tickets online electronically with a Visa or credit card that are owed to the through the court system. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you for answering our question that we asked earlier. So with that, thank you. We're going to set this bill aside for now.
I may have one.
Oh, yeah, I guess Representative Grunberg has one more.
Do we have anybody from any of the municipal police forces on the line? Just Rodney Dial. I could ask Lieutenant Dial one more question if I could.
Lieutenant Dial, are you still online?
Yes, sir. I am online.
I'm just one question. I'm looking at the proposed CS, the O version, line 31 on page 2. Again, the money may be used for the purchase and maintenance of equipment and supplies that are used by the state or by municipalities to issue electronic citations. I know in Anchorage, at least it was true a few years ago, that the police needed funding for computers in their cars, and I assume that one of the functions of those computers now with the passage of this will be to issue electronic citations, and I assume that the bill sponsor, and I'm happy to help or whatever, are going to be looking at that language. I'd like the police folks to look at the phrase to issue electronic citations and see if maybe you want to make that a little broader, so it could be for computers and things like that that may not strictly be for the issuance of citations, but can help the police, because these computers they have are very important. Lieutenant Dial, any comment?
Through the chair, I would have to do a little research and make sure that what we're currently calling mobile data terminals in some municipal departments, such as Anchorage Police Department, would be compatible with the electronic citations. I suspect that they would be, and I believe we would have some latitude there. Ideally, if this legislation were to pass, we would like to encourage municipal departments wishing to participate in an e-citation statewide program to adopt a statewide standard. That standard in and of itself would allow us to save some money by licensing one software platform, which currently is the TRAX program. But, what I envision is that we would develop a working group that would look into those issues, and we would try to make those efficiencies wherever we could.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so if anyone has any changes you want to propose to HB 108, please work with a sponsor and my staff, Ernest, and we'll bring it up at a future time. Thank you. So, thanks. What we need to do now is go back to HB 104 for a few minutes. The drafter, if everything, is like I think it is online. And I understand we have the problem with conceptual amendment number 2. You remember that one where that was the one, I believe, where we deleted section 24 and gave discretion to the drafter to make conforming amendments. He's concerned about that. Section 24 in 108. Back to 108 version uniform, and that is 104. I'm sorry, 104 version O. Yeah, wrong bill. And
section
24. And Alpheus, are you online and can explain what we did went awry? And what I'll be looking for here, I believe, is somebody to make a motion to rescind our action on amendment number 2 and set this conceptual amendment back in order. Alpheus, are you there?
Mr. Chair, I'd make that amendment to not a motion to rescind that conceptual amendment.
Well, thank you. We'll object and we'll hear what Alpheus has to say. Go, Alpheus?
Members of the committee, Chairman Keller, are you able to hear me?
Loud and clear, thank you.
Excellent. I do not believe that it's necessary to rescind your action in adopting conceptual amendment number 2. I just wanted to flag for you its interaction with the First Amendment that you adopted that was entitled 0.10. And what section 24 does, if we repeal that section, it pushes the date back by which candidates that are filing by petition to become candidates, it sets back the date at which they become or may become candidates. What the First Amendment that you adopted did was require these same candidates to file certain reports to APOC before the primary election. Some of these candidates may not, with the repeal of Section 24, actually be candidates yet. So I am looking for the committee's blessing to make amendments to your First Amendment that you adopted to conform that amendment with the repeal of Section 24 of the bill.
Okay, so would you withdraw your amendment?
I would rescind.
The rescission?
I make a motion to rescind the rescission of that amendment.
Okay, so we're back to where we were, where amendment number 2 is back on then. And is there another amendment then to conform with what Alpheus has just described, Representative Grunberg?
Let me make a suggestion.
Sure.
Mr. Bullard can come up with a new proposed amendment, and we'll take it up first next time so we have something in front of us.
No, but I think it's clear enough. I'll make the motion that we give Alpheus the latitude to use the existing 24, make it conform with the amendment that he's already described. Did I describe that fairly well, Alpheus?
Chairman Keller, what I'm looking for is I will remove Section 24 of the bill as was proposed in Conceptual Amendment 2, but I'd like to make conforming changes to the First Amendment you adopted, entitled 010, to account for that repeal. And what that would do is just to provide that if someone has filed a nominating petition before the primary election, that then they would be subject to those reporting requirements. Not that they would be required to, because they may not actually be a candidate by that time.
Okay. So the request is for a motion to make conforming amendments to our amendment number one and leave it as is. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I would request the courtesy of the chair here that we see what he has in mind. He's going to have to do it in writing anyway. And if we can just have that and take it up the first thing next time, because I'm not entirely sure what he's going to do.
Can you do that, Alpheus? Can you make a an amendment to our amended? It makes a real problem.
No. They'll come up with a new CS based on what we've done today, and he'll have just a new amendment that, with these conforming amendments, we'll take it up first, and so we see what we're voting on.
Representative Grunberg has asked that we come up with a new CS to reflect our changes in our work today, and then you come up with a new amendment to so that we can evaluate what it is that you want to do. Can we make that work for you?
Chairman Keller, I will prepare a committee substitute based on all the amendments that you have adopted today, except amendment number one, and I will prepare a new amendment number one that you may adopt if you so choose at your next committee hearing on Wednesday.
Okay,
that'll work.
That's fine.
Okay, just a second. I'm going to take a little of these. Susan, what we're doing is we're not rescinding, changing any action that we took on 104 today, and that is going to come up with a new CS. And you'll be providing us with that CS, and then along with that, you'll be providing us with a proposed amendment that we have the option of presenting to repair or make conform to one of the amendments we made today. So I think we've got that clear for the record. And okay, and thank you, Alpheus, for working with us. And I want to apologize to the committee for leading us down a trail there that I shouldn't have. And with that, we'll adjourn at 3:05.